This is HBR episode 1826 entitled HBR Community News for July 2015 and is part of the series HBR Community News. It is hosted by HBR volunteers and is about 83 minutes long. The summary is HBR Community News for July 2015.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon. You're listening to Hacker Public Radio. Joining me tonight is...
Hi, it's Dave Morris.
Hi Dave, this is the Community News Show for July 2015. Community News is a look about what's going on in and around the HBR community as done on the list, the comments, the episodes, and any other stuff that happens to come along. Unfortunately, this month, there are no new hosts, which is very sad. Otherwise, we would have introduced them.
Way it goes, I guess. We've been lucky. We've had quite a lot of hosts pretty much all this year, haven't we? Every month.
Yeah, it's been not too bad. But another way you can contribute to HBR, of course, is to get other people to contribute. So, as we always do, we go through our what's in our bag sort of stuff. And this month, what we normally do is go through the episodes quickly, and we'll also do any comments that happen to be associated with the episodes. The first up last month was 1803, What's in My Bag? Geek Dad describing his daily carry gear and bag.
Yeah, good stuff. I like these ones, don't you?
I do. Also a nice photograph of the stuff that he carries.
Yeah. That always adds a lot to it. I was impressed that it's a baby changing bag he uses, and having reused all the baby stuff from years ago in this house, I'm most impressed by that.
It's actually a good idea. There's lots of compartments and stuff usually in those things.
Yeah, they're very practical things.
I use a rucksack, and
geeks are a lot more likely than a lot of people to just repurpose whatever they have laying around.
That's true. Hi, 50. I presume it's 50.
Hey, Ken. I'm coming today from the green room of the stately Lakeside Manor. Yes, HPR listeners and friends, after a year, I'm home.
Well done. Congratulations.
Very good.
We're just going through the episodes. We're on the first one, episode 1803, What's in My Bag? And he's using a shoulder messenger bag. I use a rucksack because even though Nightwise considers people who wears rucksacks to be Boy Scouts, they don't damage your back as much as all the weight on one side in one of those messenger bags.
Yep, I agree. I do the same thing for the same reason.
Nightwise is just younger than
us. Well,
those.
I've used a laptop bag that originally was on an old 486 laptop somebody gave me and never used the bag, and then later it fit perfectly my tough book that I carried around. And I've used tool bags, stuff made to carry your tools in, and has worked very well. So you don't have to spend a lot of money on purposely built equipment bags.
That's for sure. And 1804 is What's in My Bicycle Repair Toolbox, one that was sponsored by you, I guess. What's in My Toolkit? I think you had a What's in Your Toolbox as well at one stage.
Yeah, What's in My Pickup Toolbox. Yeah, I really enjoyed this because I didn't realize there were so many tools, you know, non-generalized tools that were required to do basic bicycle repair. I mean, I had a 10-speed in college, and I think the only thing I had other than my regular toolkit was the deal that separated the chain and put it back together. But I wasn't going down and taking the sprockets apart or anything like that either.
Yeah, it like everything else, you can get away without having the specialized tools. I used to change those chains with just a sawn off nail and a good vise. But it gets a lot easier if you have the specialized tools for that. But a nice episode from John, I think.
Yeah, some good stuff there. I was quite impressed. I think I recognized a few of them, but could have done with a few pictures, but you know,
there you go. I was thinking the very same thing myself. So the following day we had 1805, which was 56th in the LibreOffice series, Objects and Styles presentation by Hooker. And this was the introduction to the styles in Impress. Very good stuff.
Yeah, I think I understand a lot more about how to do these types of things now, having listened to these. It was all seat-of-the-pants stuff back in the day when I used to do this type of thing.
Yeah, very much. The following episode was the community news show. I don't know if there have been any comments on any of these, Dave. Have you been keeping an eye?
No, they haven't, but I think there was on the community news, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, Kevin O'Brien.
Yes, Kevin's saying sorry he missed the show, but he did produce four more shows over the weekend, that particular weekend, so I think he's asked to be forgiven.
No, absolutely no need to be forgiven, and he's uploaded a few since then as well, so they're coming, and he's sorted out the material on the site, so some sort of compilation for would be nice, I think. Do we have that as an item on the GitHub page?
Something relating to Kevin's shows, but I can't remember what it is. You wrote it.
Yeah, I pasted in the links, and we need to go back and add them to the show notes. And I also wanted to put in make a DVD available with his shows and the material associated with them. So we had CGM with an episode on Arch Linux development environment, episode 1, and this was general everyday stuff about how to install. Basically, it was an introduction to Arch Linux install process and all the steps that you might go through to do it. And very detailed show notes, all very very clear. You could step through it, and quite a lot of it would be thing I like about Arch Linux is a lot of the commands are just the basic tools that you can use on any system, obviously aside from Pacman, of course, but the rest of the stuff like fstab and dd and that sort of thing is pretty standard stuff.
Yeah, it was a great show, I thought. Yeah, I loved his the amount of research he'd obviously put into it and work to produce documentation. It's very impressive.
Well, the Arch Wiki is a great resource, no matter what distribution you're running in, unlike a lot of the other documentation, it's not just how to get an application installed, but it's how to use the applications once you have them.
Yeah, excellent resources, in fairness. 1808 is one of these oddball ones, The Shooting of Dan McGrew by Robert W. Service. And this was for David Whitman's birthday. He read out the work. Its copyright's expired, so it is now forever within the commons here on HPR. I really enjoy this because I know quite a... I've attended... I don't know, do you ever have those events around Christmas Christmas or whatever the festive season is in your parts, where you go to a local drama society thing, and there was always one gentleman who did a rendition of this. He's since passed away, but just reminded me very much of those times.
Yeah, it reminded me of family Christmases when I was very young, where various uncles would sort of stand up and declaim, and that sort of thing. But not that particular thing. Yeah, we had a strange family. It didn't last very long, but it did happen.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah, we don't have much of that over on this side of the pond. At least I've never been a big fan of poetry. But if more poetry were like this, I would be.
Not 100% sure it'd be everybody's cup of tea, but I enjoyed it. I used to enjoy it then as well. So, yeah, pretty cool. 1809, the new...
Hang on, there was a comment. You missed the comment.
Sorry, go.
The comment was from Mike. I'm not sure which Mike that was. I assumed it was Mike Ray, but he didn't say. He was saying, more. Great. Can we have ballads of a Chicha Code next, which is something I know nothing of. Again, revealing my ignorance, I guess. Love the lines about the Northern Lights, he says.
Very, very nice. Yeah, more of this sort of stuff. Keep it coming. You know the rule? Anything of interest to hackers. There you go. The following day we had the new used touch, Kindle Touch, and I had to chuckle about this. I really, his secondhand stores or the thrift stores that he's going to are a lot more well-stocked than the ones that I have, I must say.
Same here. I've had chats with him about this. I've been to my kids and I were in California a few years ago, and my son was particularly keen to make a beeline for the thrift shops. I can't remember the name of it now, but found some quite cool stuff in there actually. But as you say, it doesn't seem to be happening this side of the Atlantic. I have no idea why.
Well, there's a here in the Netherlands a Kringloopwinkel. They recycle. Well, they call it the Circle of Life shops. And you can go in there, and I just happened to be passing one today and went in for a look, and they were selling like old slide projectors and stuff, you know, and CRT monitors and that sort of thing is where they were at.
It's over here, it seems to be massively expensive for what it is. If you look in all there's so-called charity shops all up and down the high streets and side streets and stuff, but they're all got hell of a markup on them.
Interesting. Well, he got a Kindle Touch and basically had the Kindle Touch explain to us why it was better than the new ones, and I was convinced for sure.
That was a great idea. It's a really good way to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they add the new hotness technology and then they drop all the features that you're used to using.
Well, they had to remove the they were forced by the audio people to remove the text to speech, which I personally consider to be a sin to society in general. Anyway, 1810, LastPass hack. What does it mean? By a hooker who went and gave us a very good rundown of what happened and why you should be slightly concerned but not too concerned. Just goes to show actually that it proves a few things actually. They were doing everything correctly. They limited the damage. They did proper disclosure, they seem to do everything right. But still, no matter how good your systems are, eventually they will get breached. So there you go.
Yeah, I hadn't quite appreciated the points that Ahuka made, that the attack was not as effective, because all the headlines seem to be saying it was the end of the world and stuff. So I thought it was quite good that he explained exactly how much we should be concerned about it.
I mean, it does highlight the reason I don't use that, and I use KeePass Exchange, our local KeePass store here, which I sync around the file, and I have that's for my wife, and for myself I use basically an encrypted text file for my passwords. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't use LastPass either for the same reason, but a lot of people do, I know.
50, what do you use?
Well, I mean, like a lot of these times you hear about hacked, if they don't get the hash for the passwords, they don't have a whole lot. There are some things like the first Sony hack, they said, well, they got your email addresses, but they don't have your passwords. So there's a little bit you can probably do.
Hold on, your Xylon, stop. Hello, 50, Earth calling 50, come in over.
So
You're dropping in and out. I don't know if it's to everybody or just me.
No, same here.
What sort of a connection have you got now?
He uses the same password for everything. Find their.
I can't hear what he's saying. Can you, Dave?
No, I can't. No, he's fading in and out.
50, we can't hear you. 50?
On another site that's not as secure.
We got absolutely none of that 50. You were cutting in and out. Hello, can you hear us?
Yeah, I was just looking. I'm here on the phone. I see a download going that I didn't start. I was trying to kill it.
Okay, well, we didn't hear any of what you said, so if you could repeat it, that'd be great.
Did you mean you didn't hear just now? You didn't hear what I said, or you?
No, you went. You had your last monologue. We didn't hear anything you said.
I was just saying something about Ahuka said a lot of these times you hear about somebody getting hacked. It's not as bad as you might think, as they don't get the hash to the passwords. And he did a real good job of explaining how much work they would have to do to crack the passwords, even if they, and things like the Sony a couple years ago, the first Sony hack, they got the passwords are hashed, so they got email addresses for everybody, but that was about it.
But I don't, one of the things I don't think he clearly explained, or he kind of did, targeted attack against you. If you're going for a targeted attack against a particular individual, this makes it a lot easier if you do know the salt, because you can use that salt then to generate the hash tables, and the hash tables can then be used to brute force, or not to brute force, to work out what the password was based on the hash. Do you know? Okay, I'll give a quick my understanding of what salt is. You had, in a regular password system, you can create what are called rainbow tables. So you can take the letter AA, however many letters. So you can start with AAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAAA several computers or botnets, then you can create rainbow tables that run into several different, several gigabytes of data and sometimes even terabytes of data, depending on the length of passwords that you use and the different combinations. So that way, once you have the rainbow tables generated, you can then take any hash and you can go, it starts with the number 2. So you go into the DVD that has the number 2, and then the next number is A, and you go to A, and then it's very easy to having the hash to find out what the password was, because you've worked out all the possible passwords. What salting does means that for every single person, the rainbow tables would need to be generated for every individual person, because you put in a salt in front and you say, I hash it with my my piece of salt, whatever that happens to be. If you don't know the salt, it makes it extremely difficult, because you need, not only is your password getting longer by the length of the salt or by the algorithm that you use, but it also becomes unique to you, so that it makes it very, very expensive computationally wise to generate all these rainbow tables. However, if you do know the salt, as they do now in this case, and they're able to get your hash through one means or another, as in they're able to get it flying through the wire, then it is possible that they will be able to generate, for targeted individuals, enough rainbow tables. That's not to say it will be impossible to do. It would just make it not worth the while for a regular Joe Schmo on the street, because it'll take thousands of dollars to do. However, if you're going after somebody in particular, then it makes it an awful lot easier to target that particular individual.
Right. Ahuga did mention, if you have the resources of, say, a nation state, the individual is pretty much out of luck.
Yeah, exactly. So, but if any of this or anything that Ahuga says is incorrect, feel free to do a show about it.
One thing I did want to throw out there, what seems a lot more dangerous than this, while picking up stories for the KPO that wasn't aired last week or didn't get recorded, one of the ones I came across is LifeLock. I don't know if you guys see, you hadn't probably seen the ads over there at the company president putting his social security number on top of the side of a truck. And, you know, that was the gimmick. Oh, you know, we'll keep a watch on your credit cards, and if anybody opens an account in your name and blah, blah, blah. I didn't realize how, I knew they'd gotten in trouble a few years ago. I didn't realize how bad it was from this. This is a recent article. According to the article, apparently they stored everything on their servers in plain text and got pwned. At least my understanding from an article, I don't have internet yet except for the phone. So I can't open the article and look at it right now. But, the reason this came up again, whatever regulatory agency got on and fined them in the first place, I think it was the FTC, said, published, here it is 3 years later, and they haven't changed anything. So there are some, the exact nature of what they're going to slap them down this time on is still classified, but they haven't released exactly what the circumstances are of this time. But if essentially, from the article, it boiled down to we've given them 3 years to clean up their act, and they really haven't done anything.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for running your own stuff if you can secure it correctly. Okay, the 1811 Life and Times of a Geek Part 2 by Mr. Morris. Excellent show, Dave. I even downloaded and watched those videos. Very impressed at your history background, I must say.
You can see why it took me 6 months to prepare this, apart from sort of motivation going in and out. But I got lost looking at all this stuff and remembering things.
And there's quite a few comments. Charlie Egbert says, my father worked for Control Data. I started coding a Fortran myself in 1975 post-Vietnam. I was very interested to hear your experience. I felt very envious of the people who didn't have to punch their own software.
Yes, and I responded to that saying, we got cards punched up for free by the data preparation staff, but there was the opportunity to learn how to operate a card punch, which you do if you just had a few cards to insert into a deck or something, and card punches are quite smart. You had a programming facility within them. You put a program card into the thing, which did things like jumping to the right column and that type of thing as you were punching them up. So I said to Charlie, perhaps he should do a show about his own experiences on HPR.
Yeah, very true. Then we also had a comment from Mike Ray. Hi, Dave. In an emergency queue, there's a show did about a thing I made out of an empty cereal box, some of my mom's knitting needles, and some punch cards when I was about 7, under supervision of my brother, who was more geeky than me. It was like the thing you described, pulling a knitting needle out of the box, made the card drop out of the bottom that corresponded to the needle that was pulled. I used a bamboo skewer in the show version. In COBOL, I seem to remember the sequence number were in columns 1 to 6. Column 7 was an asterisk for a comment, and a solidius for a continuation or nothing.
Yeah, and I said, glad you liked the episode. Your emergency show sounds like fun. My kids would have liked that when they were young. I'm sad we didn't think of something similar. He was referring to the punch card thing, the edge punch cards that I was talking about, that people did use quite a lot in those days for the sort of hardware database type of thing. And I said I'd forgotten the layout of COBOL cards. Didn't do a lot of COBOL, only a couple of programs in it ever, and that was just to prove that I could do it. But he's quite right, of course.
And if you want to hear that show that he's referring to, if you go to the calendar page, it's under emergency shows, and those the emergency queue is intended only to be used in case where there is still a gap in the schedule 24 hours prior to release. There are 7 emergency shows, all are available in MP3 AUG and Speaks format, and the show notes are also available. So the next show was Headphones and the $2 Microphone by John Culp. And gives a rundown of his mics, and I really like his mini lapel. It seemed to work quite well.
Yeah, I followed his lead there and bought. There's a you can buy a set of 3 for some small number of pounds on Amazon. So I've got them laying on the table in front of me. I haven't used them yet, but they look fine, and they sounded great, as you say.
I think they might be interesting for plugging into a splitter and into one of the Zooms for recordings. I'd like to check that out, see how it works.
Yeah. You're thinking of having one for the interviewer and one for the interviewee or something?
Correct, yeah.
Cool.
And you left some comments. Do you want to read it yourself, or shall I do that for you?
I said to John, I love the ambient sounds. It was very enjoyable. It was fun to be accompanying you on your walk. Thanks for the description of what was going on around you. And some of those headphones sounded interesting, as did the microphone. So,
what's interesting is how close he lives to his work. Oh my God. five seconds, he could run over.
Yeah. It sounded like he's got an interesting walk too, but judging by what he was telling us about.
Yeah, exactly. Very nice. And then he replied back about the heavy breathing. Thanks, Dave. I enjoyed recording this way, but I'm not a fan of the resultant heavy breathing. Planning to record a brief outdoor episode today, but I think I'll just sit by the swamp or something. No, actually, I didn't find it at all distracting. It was like you were just walking along with somebody and they were breathing and talking.
Well, that's what I said in reply. I said it's not heavy breathing, it was just breathing, and it didn't bother me at all. As you said, it's what happens. Your breathing rate changes as you move. You may be walking up a hill or something, and when you're walking and talking, that happens. Certainly happens to me, anyway.
And the clue was in the description, the summary, which was read out. I talk about my various headphones as I walk to my office. So yeah, there was no surprise there for anyone. John Corliss said, I agree with Dave. It was really enjoyable to listen to. The very informal nature of joining you on a walk to work and hearing commentary about what you saw along the way was at least as fun as the intended content on the headphones, which was also good. Smiley face. Thanks, John. So 100% approval rate there for John's episode.
Yeah, I just love to hear that, you can form a picture of the scene in your mind as you listen to that sort of thing. I think that's a great thing to do.
Absolutely. Very, very true. Okay, day 1813, Windigo again with three episodes, wasting episodes by putting them into one show. Apt, spelunking, surf, light year, and FB term. Apt spelunking is a silly term that he made up the act of searching through a Debian repository looking for random stuff. Did any of you get a chance to use any of these apps?
I didn't. I followed them up to the extent of just checking out what they were, but I didn't actually. I tried FB term, actually. I couldn't get it to work. I did try that, but I didn't spend a lot of time trying to make it run.
Seems like I got very worried about that Lighty Years, because it sounds like the sort of game that I would find myself going, this is ridiculously simple, and then 48 hours later I'm there still working away on it.
I try very hard to avoid those sorts of things these days. I know how easy it is to fall into that black hole.
And the lightweight graphical browser is always handy to have. And I have tried this one, because I when testing the website, I downloaded everything with web browser on there, and it does what it says on the tin. It's very, very simple.
Yeah, Windigo does seem to have a tremendous compendium of fascinating programs, actually. He's mentioned other things in other contexts, which are really, really cool. More, please, more.
And his avatar is extremely interesting. He needs to explain it.
I know. I've looked at that and wondered, what? What's going on there?
It's just, absolutely. We need context. Speaking of custom context menus in these GUI file managers, see what I did there?
You're forgetting the comments. Do you want me to do the comments?
Oh, please do. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm new to this.
So we had one comment from one of these hexadecimal chappies who always throws me with the handles, 0xf10e.
Do you say the 0x if it's just
F10e? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's there, isn't it? I mean, you know, it was hex. You would know it's hex by the fact that it's got hexadecimal things in it. But I don't know. We should ask the owner.
I once made the mistake of replying to an email capitalizing somebody's handle. They were not amused.
Oh, yes. That's not polite, I think. Anyway, grumpiness was a comment, and the question was, you mean get grumpy like a sysadmin or network operator when someone breaks their network? I forget the context now. Do you remember?
I don't, actually.
It made sense when I was listening to the show or soon after. But anyway, the other comment, the remainder of the comment was, by the way, did you know MPlayer has FB dev video output, so you can play videos on the frame buffer too? Sounds very cool.
Yes, to which he replies he did not know about that option, and sounds like a wonderful project. MPlayer is absolutely awesome what that thing can do. You know you can play videos in the in ASCII mode. Yes, why would you ever do that? Go on.
I've never tried to do it. Quite. Why would you want to do that, Ken?
Well, my job title is Senior Video on Demand Engineer, and sometimes you telnet or SSH into a server on the other side, and you can connect to this, you can connect to the setup box port and check to see if the video is actually playing on that side using ASCII. And then you go, right, guys, it's playing there. Look, the stream is that far. Can we please move on?
That sounds good. I can't ever imagine wanting to do that myself, but I'm impressed that you have a use.
It's for quite a lot of things. You'd be surprised, especially, you know, podcasts or whatever. You get a lot out of just playing it in ASCII. But FBDev is actually also pretty cool. You know, no, really, really small system. Boom. And up it comes. Pretty cool.
Again, it was worth the effort of showing up today just to hear a legitimate use case for ASCII video mode. I just thought that was something they were bored and threw in one day.
Oh, that has saved me so many times. You just prove the video is getting that far. Look, it's playing there on this port on this server. All right, thank you very much. Move on. Not my problem from here on then. But quite a lot of them, if you just squint a little bit, you can get more or less the movie where it is.
Sounds like the Matrix to me. I'm not sure.
If you want to edit a video, whether you're looking at it in ASCII or, you know, if you want an in and out scene, you just want a particular scene, quickly view it in ASCII, get the in scene, the out scene, edit the video to that point. Hundreds of uses for it, guys. Hundreds of uses. No one seems convinced.
We believe you.
All right. Watching videos at work, you know yourself. Nobody's going to think anyone's stupid enough to watch it in ASCII. If you're just interested in the soundtrack. All right, I'll stop. Anyway, John's next one was custom context menus in GNU Linux GUI file managers. And I'm not 100% sure. Did he mention any of the KDE ones, like Dolphin or whatever? Is that supported on those?
I don't think he did, and because as I listened to it, I rushed off and tried to get find out how to do it with Dolphin, and it is possible, but it's a lot more involved than at least with Thunar, which I have managed to get working.
Yeah, but it seems like a absolutely awesome little thing to be able to do.
It's a cool thing to do, yeah.
Yeah, adding your own custom menus, that's really right-click and, you know, destroy planet. Excellent, love it. Following day, 1815, LibreOffice Impress, Style and Objects 2, Drawing an Object. And this is I could never understand why LibreOffice Impress was doing all this stuff. And then, the moment, it's, you know, it's they're using the same, the drawing objects are being shared between two components. So that just explains so much stuff to me.
It means you can do some pretty cool slides, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And at the start of the Impress series, I didn't think I was going to be getting anything from it, but actually it's been probably more informative than any of the other ones. It's quite a lot of the stuff was just refreshing, but this is all kind of new stuff with Impress. I don't really just slap a presentation together and be done with it, you know?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I felt the same way, even though I haven't done a presentation ever with this, and I haven't done a presentation with anything for many years. So, but no, good point.
Were there any comments for any of these shows, by the way?
None on either of the last two, no.
And there's none on visualizing HPR tags. Dave, I think you went out on one on this. I am 100% sure that in the fullness of time, I will be coming back to this after 2 hours of frantically searching to remember where exactly I heard about this tool. And that's where I'm filing this one in under.
I have to admit that this was the result of me thinking, it's about time I did a show. What can I do one on? Oh, I know. I'll just do that. And and then afterwards thinking, I think I maybe lost my audience a bit on that one. Still, it filled a slot, didn't it?
No, well, you did and you didn't. I particularly like the HTML VI code. Your code is so clean, Dave, I cry a little inside that my code is not as nice as your code.
But you just need to feed it through the Perl tidying stuff, and it
sure.
prettifies quite a lot.
Yeah, I think my if I did that, the thing would gain sentience so that it could come around and slap me about the face for producing such bad code.
It does sometimes tell you your code is rubbish, or if you run it through the thing that matches up with the Perl best practices book, which is a massive tome on how to write Perl and how not to write it, and there's a whole library which will read a Perl script and complain about it, then my goodness me, you think, well, I've done a good script here, and it comes back and says, no, this is rubbish, it's too long. It's quite a sort of chastising process. It makes you stop and think.
Yeah. I'd like actually to wonder if there's anyone out there who's got a better use for GraphViz than this. You know, one that, not to put too fine a point on it, but there's too many tags for this to be useful, I thought.
Yeah, I know. I did say as much, both in my notes and in the show, but it was really just a thing. I wonder if this will work, and why don't I share this sort of thing that's going on there. But yeah, GraphViz is very, very good. You can do some really clever stuff. I just don't know enough of it to make what I did look good.
Yeah, if there's anyone out listening who has a on graphing programs in general, there's a requested topic for GNU Plot, and we could definitely put this up there as well for, you know, visualization tools. I think that would be something that a lot of people would like to have. A lot of people struggle with it. I know I do. And sometimes I have quite a lot of data that I can read myself, but to put into presentations or something, having a graph makes a lot more sense for other humans.
Well, one of the uses that I have made of it in the past, not directly, but through the GRAMPS genealogy program, if you've ever seen that.
I have indeed. I'm very familiar with that.
It has a family tree. It's got lots of plugins. One of them is a GraphViz thing, and it does a huge, huge family tree thing that shows all the relationships between all the people that you have in your database. And I had access to an A3 printer at one time that I could produce quite tiny little writing trees on, and you know, great thing to stick up on the wall if you're into that sort of thing.
I am indeed, Dave. I am indeed. I do have my family tree in GRAMPS, and I have it on my list of stuff that I'd like to do, is to use a projector to project it onto the wall and then go over it with ink and ink it in.
Yes, that's a good one. Yeah. It's quite interesting, and sometimes you can get your kids interested in it as well. I think I more or less failed when I tried it, but I believe that it's quite nice if you can interest your children in this sort of thing, if possible, because otherwise the whole family tree business can just fall by the wayside, you know, because it needs to be carried on from generation to generation, if you possibly, you know, the knowledge about previous generations.
Well, it's interesting, Dave, you mentioned children, and Ken Fallon mentioned doing presentations, I presume, for his supervisors. And that just seems to me a direct correlation between the types of information that you have to provide to both groups. You can't go too deep, and it's got to be something they can immediately understand.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Although the prospect of doing a presentation for your kids, I'm not sure how many would...
what are you talking about? That?
Children.
What, you don't have presentation breakfast?
That's right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Get the screen, the projector out, and oh, aye.
That's it, exactly. The following day was one of these episodes where I went jumping around the house like a little happy bunny. It was 1817 gathering parts, and it is NY Bill talking about the process he goes through when starting an electronics project. And this, to me, was so simple, so friggin' obvious, that I had never thought to actually do this. The amount of electronic projects I've started and found that I was missing a piece and then had to order something, and then it comes back and something has been dumped on the table and the whole thing is just a regular old mess. This is absolutely excellent, and I can put it into a little plastic bag, all the components with the list, and then just leave it there as a project ready to do for when I do get all the components. Excellent, 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 excellent.
Yes,
and I like his idea. If you're ordering, you know, you find you need resistor X, you might as well order 20 of them, because the shipping is going to be as much as the cost of multiple units.
Absolutely. He also had a very good tip of, you know, going to the one site and making a shopping list and adding everything to that, and then, you know, logging out and logging back in and taking stuff off the list and only buying the things there that you absolutely needed. I know Deal Extreme offers that as well as an option. So excellent, excellent tips. Nothing like, there was nothing about the show that was like mind. It could be, it's electronics, but it could equally be repairing your lawnmower or something. You know, it was just, here's how to approach a complex project so that, you know, you can get it under control. Project management. My God, project management on HBR at last.
Oh, dear.
There was also a very good thing in there that any of the ham radio enthusiasts who have to do your advanced exam should take it out, and that is how to tell the colors of a resistor. He has like a little rhyme thing. I don't think he covered that in the episode, did he?
He referred to the two red lips thing, and he caught himself saying it and then laughed and said, oh yeah, this is how I remember stuff. But he must have come back and added this in just to fill in the gaps, which I thought was a fantastic thing to do.
I've a wall full of like helpful, useful things, and this is now added up there, because that'll be handy for when I do my ham radio exam. I'm hoping that will come up. An easy question on resistors.
Yeah, impressive. Yeah.
Anyway, CPROM said,
Ken, since you're going to have a ham license, have you seen this Arduino shield that broadcasts and receives in the long range in the ham frequency? Is that anything you think you could find a use for?
Absolutely, but I'm not allowed to own it until I have a ham license. Did you do a show about that, or did I heard you talking about that on one of the other shows?
I mentioned it on KPO once.
Yeah, I went and looked it up after hearing you talk about that. Looks very, very nice. It's also mentioned in the DARP magazine, which is the Dutch a Dutch ham radio magazine. So they mentioned it as well. It's pretty cool. Anyway, CPROMPT said, great show. Loved the show in my bill. Definitely do an update so that we can see the result. Let us know which version of the pedal you're going to do. You might be interested in these guys too, which is mojotone.com. I used to work for them a few years ago, and they have some nice quality stuff, nice kits you can build on your own and such. Nice vintage style amps. Thanks for the show.
Cool. And you replied, you sent a comment in saying series on electronic components. While you might think this is obvious, this episode is a great practical tip for starting electronic projects. Can I suggest that HBR listeners contribute a list of sites they use to get components, and then we put that up on the GitLab repo and then sync it to the main HBR website? So it's a list of possibles, and I do agree with that. That would be a great idea, because I know there's some obviously some good places around New York, but around Edinburgh, I don't know, or in England, or in Great Britain in general, I'm not so sure about. And you said also, I'd love you or someone else to do a series on electronics components. This is the resistor. They look like this. They're used for, they cost about, here are the following types, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I think that would be a brilliant thing to do.
I love that, yeah. And C-Prompt, or NY Bill, reply back, thanks, C-Prompt. That must have been an interesting place to work, and there will be a follow-up. I told you how I found the board layout online, so there will be some etching too. Ooh, excellent. Good fun. Yeah, the idea did cross my mind. Ken, do an episode on each different components, and we'll see if I get off my butt and do that. I really, really hope he does, because I would like to get into electronics more, and sometimes I'm just, you know, when you study electronics, there's going to be guys there who will tell you, technicians or whoever, don't do that or do this or here's a tip. And that's the sort of thing that I'd really like to, I've really felt I missed having a mechanical engineering background. The following day, we had 5150, 1818, a review of HBR's interview recorder, the Zoom H1.
Yeah, and if anybody needs, or next time somebody needs that, you know, everybody keep in mind, it's still here in this room somewhere in one of these boxes.
Does that have a, because I have the Zoom H2, does that happen to have a line monitor that you can listen to what's been recorded?
Yeah, I believe so.
Did you use that by any chance?
No, I just walked, well, I had one walking interview and that one disappeared. It didn't disappear, but I mean, the audio wasn't there at all. I don't know what happened on that, because
probably they haven't pressed record twice.
I recorded a talk of Eric, by Eric Raymond with the approval of everybody in the room, and that hadn't gone out yet. But it was like in a conference room in the hotel, probably seated like 80 people. We didn't have that many in there, but it's fairly big. And I just set the Zoom on a chair between Eric and I was in the front row, and it caught every part of it. It caught questions from the back of the room just beautifully. But the day before, I was with one of the guys, and I'm sorry, the name escapes me. If you've seen the viral video of Iron Man, Tony Stark, actor's name escapes me, which is ridiculous, but presenting the kid with the Iron Man arm, these were the guys who printed it, and they came. Awesome. This was PenguinCon, and so I asked them about getting interviewed, and finally got back and found them the next day, and they literally caught the one guy walking out of the hotel. He said, yeah, if you can walk with me, I can do an interview. And I was surprised. I didn't get a bit of it.
Yeah, they Zoom has a, you have to press it once to get the levels and the red light flashes, and then you have to press it twice for it to actually record. So I think everybody who's owned a Zoom has been caught with that, which is why I also use the backup Sansa clip, which I just put on record the whole time and then just clip it to people's lapels. And I had that exact same thing happen to me when I was recording in Fosdam, but I was able to recover one of the episodes from the recorder on their lapel. Yep.
I'm not sure that was it, because I got several minutes of static. I just didn't get a recording. I think if I didn't hit it twice, I would have got anything recorded.
Okay, well, moral of the story is have a backup device, regardless. Following day, 1819, LibreOffice tips horizontal lists and headless operation by John Culp, no less. And Ahuka was kind enough to allow this to go into the LibreOffice series. So it took me a while to get my head around what a horizontal list was and what he's trying to do. And then I finally got it. But it's not, I must say, a use case that I have needed to have myself.
No, I could see there might be some rare circumstances where you might want to do that. He was talking about putting in the footer or the header or something. I quite like the idea of making columns to do it, but quite what would happen once you'd filled up all the columns, I wasn't quite clear about. Presumably it just wraps to the first one again. So, but nice idea.
Yeah, another one where a image would have helped, I think.
Well, I can see where this would have great applications for academia. The thing is that they've, most places, I think they've moved on from actually typing up your tests in a word processor. And it's unfortunate because at least the school that I worked for, and I think this is fairly common, they have a deal. They have software they buy at great expense, and they go online and they do these tests, and then they project the test onto the wall of the classroom, and each of the kids have a clicker that they select A, B, C, or D on these multiple choice tests. Now I totally see why the schools do this as job retention, because I think the days of the teacher spending 6 hours grading papers after the school bell rings is long gone. This stuff is already, you know, it's already recorded and in the automatically in the grade book. But unfortunately, if you test like this, then you've got no opportunity to do essay questions.
I did like the tip on the headless operation, which I didn't even know was a thing in LibreOffice, where you can convert to HTML or convert a document to ODT. Very handy.
That's a cool feature. Yeah, I can see me using that.
I wonder, are there many other options? So like converting a document to a PDF, which is what I tend to do quite a lot.
Since the thing itself can do the PDFs, I would imagine that the headless function would do it as well, but don't know that for a fact.
So there was no comments on that particular episode, which brings us to 1820, Canonsys Linux Fest, interview one of two with Alex Juarez, is that correct? Rackspix Principal Engineer.
Juarez.
Yeah, sorry, I'm very, very bad at pronouncing people's names. And this was a cool interview, 50. They seem to really Rackspace.
Well, thanks. A lot of it was, and you probably saw my technique in there. I wasn't, and I did this with about every person that I interviewed from his fest. I mean, I have a real good idea what Rackspace does, and a better idea since meeting those guys at the KLF. But since that's not the type of service that I, especially on a business level, that I have any kind of experience of securing, of renting the, you know, renting a server or anything, I wasn't sure I was quite up to the task of asking the right questions. So I came back to my old trick of saying, okay, well, that's about all I had. Is there anything else you think our listeners ought to know?
Always a good question.
I'm sure there are probably some people who've listened that said, yeah, why didn't you ask them this or ask them that? Well, put it in the show notes. I'm sure they'll be back next year.
True for you.
But, you know, that and the thing I got from it, I expected Rackspace to show up. They were going to be trying to sell their service. No, really, you could definitely tell they were trying to sell themselves as employers.
Yeah. The following day, we had 1821, James Beard's Never Fail Blender Holidays Sauce, in response to the wok episode from earlier on. Franks describes James Beard's simple recipe. Is James Beard a well-known thing?
I looked up a little bit about him, and he was a well-regarded cook, from what I saw. I think he's got a Wikipedia page. You can read all about him. Sounds like he's had an interesting career, but he's passed away since then. But yeah, obviously a yardstick to go to for all sorts of recipes of this sort.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, I'd not heard the name before this podcast, but apparently in that generation of cooks, that they write the big cookbook instead of having a TV show where they yell at people and humiliate them and throw knives and such.
Yeah, probably safer.
But no, when I saw this on the library, I immediately went out and downloaded it ahead of time. But I really didn't get a chance to listen to it till the broadcast day. Not to leave anybody with an unsavory image, but HPR's daily format and the length is usually just perfect for listening to while I shower and shave in the morning. But so I waited till then and just got it off the stream. But this is something I really want to do because a year and a half ago, I tried to make hollandaise sauce. I don't remember what I was going to put it on in the conventional way. You know, you stir with one hand and you pour with the other and you're standing there for an hour. And it was a complete disaster. So I look forward to trying this automated method.
Never made hollandaise sauce. Not really a cook type person myself.
I'm not a great fan of these sorts of sauces personally, but it's basically you're making an emulsion, I think, isn't it? It's you're having to mix together stuff that doesn't want to mix, and so it's all about sort of beating the hell out of it to mix.
Oh yeah, I got a probably recipe off the internet rather than the cookbook, but every time you see the recipe, oh yeah, there's a knack to it. But really, if you follow our directions, it's very, very very easy. Well, that's easy to say when you're writing an article on the internet.
The next one was 1822, Some Tips on Image Magic, and by Dave Morris. And this one is pretty cool, Dave. I've used, I think, everything that you have mentioned in your show, but I am not as yet able to do shows about it due to the fact I usually do it for work, and I'm waiting for them to get to the legal department to get back to me to make sure I can talk about this stuff. Not that it's that secret, it's just I want to make sure all my shows are legally allowed to be distributed.
Yeah, fair enough. It's not exactly world-shattering stuff, but if you haven't come across the image magic capabilities, then you know somebody sort of pointing at it and saying, you know, it's pretty straightforward to use, and there's tons of information about it. I hope
absolutely
it would, maybe be helpful to people who hadn't experimented with it yet.
Image
well,
magic.
And it's good to have an introduction to a different graphics editor, because a lot of people, well, I think GIMP is probably the more powerful of the two, and a lot of people start out with it and stick with it because that's what they know. But listening to this episode made me think, well, maybe I should fire up Image Magic, because it's usually installed with the distro, or quite often, and just see what it has for little simple projects.
But it's quite nice that you can do batches of stuff, you know, like the fact that you can run through a list of files in a short script, or a command line pipe or something, and do that thing that you need to do to all of them. That's the reason I use it. I agree, GIMP is more powerful, as is Krita, by the way. I found Krita to be damn good. But, it's just great for that sort of batch of changes that you might want to do.
And there are plugins for every library there under the sun, for Ruby, PHP, Pythons, whatever. You can download Image Magic plugins that you can do all these things in the language of your choice. Guaranteed, probably 90 to 99% of websites that do anything with images are using Image Magic in the background. It's extremely handy for automating stuff. So the following day, we had the last of your interviews from Kansas Linux Fest, and it was the one of the organizers. Is that correct?
Yeah, Ryan Sipes. He's right after Mike DuPont, who's an HPR contributor. He's probably almost equally responsible for the fact that there was a Kansas Linux Fest. He restarted the local lug in Lawrence, Kansas. He is the head IT person for the public library system in the northeast part of Kansas. That's there's 4 or 6 districts in Kansas. And apparently when he came in there 2 or 3 years ago, they were already heavily open source. And I, you know, unlike a lot of it, go into something, have a lot of frustration pushing them towards open source. They're, you know, they were very receptive. So I think they're pretty much 100% open source now. As I mentioned, I don't want to rehash the article. He's also a huge contributor to what at the time when I interviewed him was Evolve OS, and they ran into some copyright problems. So they've gone back to using the old Solos OS name, even though it's completely different project, for the distribution that Ikey Doherty is the lead programmer on. And this is something new, since Ryan has a new project that I'm sure you'll hear about in the next week or so. It's called Mycroft.ai. Well, I mean, the website's Mycroft.ai, is in artificial intelligence. Mycroft is in Sherlock Holmes's older, smarter brother. And this is a project based on a Raspberry Pi. He'd released pictures. They're making cases for now, 3D printed. I'm sure they're going to have a Kickstarter campaign starting this next week. And I'm sure they'd probably be going to pre-print, you know, conventionally printed cases. But what this is, I believe it's meant to duplicate a lot of the functions of the Amazon Echo without the processing of the voice commands having to go out over the internet to a server and come back. So in other words, it's not there sitting there listening to everything. Well, it is listening to everything that's said around it, but it's not forwarding it to the internet. And I guess there's supposed to be some home automation functions. It's, like I said, if I had a computer in front of me, I could tell you the software. It's based on a voice recognition, well, sort of an interactive 50, AI program.
Why don't you,
something
you'd
build to challenge the Turing test that was developed by Google, or developed at Google. So there's, essentially, I think it's going to do a lot of the functions of the Echo plus a whole lot more.
I was just going to say, could you do a short episode whenever that Kickstarter comes out and give us a summary then?
Yeah, I will. And he may be on one or both shows next week. Since I don't have internet here other than this phone, I don't know if I will be, but I think that this was being on today's kind of trial to see if I could participate just using the phone. Sorry to ramble. When I first got this project, I invited Ryan to come on both Colonel Panic Ogcast, that's ColonelPanicOgcast.net, ka-ching, and the Linux Slugcast, LinuxSlugcast.com, and Linux Slugcast is going to be on Friday.
We've lost him again.
On one or both shows. I'm expecting 50. Him to, at least, because he seemed enthusiastic. Yes, Ken, I was going to tell Ryan this first, but if they get in person.
I don't think he can interrupt him with his phone. He doesn't hear us until he stops talking.
I'm sorry, I should talk in smaller bits.
Yeah, you're chopping out, and you because you're not stopping to talk, nothing is getting through to say that you're chopping out.
Oh, of course, it's buffering. Okay, first question, Ken. Yeah, they're only Lawrence, Kansas is only about a 4.5-hour drive. So if Mycroft.ai gets funded, I fully intend to drive up there some weekend and do an in-person interview with Ryan.
Excellent.
At the they're actually building these things at the entrepreneur. Did I cut out again?
Yeah, you're putting in notes all the time.
Okay, let me try one sentence at a time. If the project gets funded...
Yeah, no, I got that. If the project gets funded, you're going to go and interview.
Okay, okay. And the other part was that I, since the Kickstarter is starting this week, I expect Ryan will show up on one or both of Linux Ludcast on Friday and the Kernel Panic Odcast on Saturday.
Okay, cool. There was one comment to this show, which was by Anonymous. Sound quality is absolutely awful, unbearable. And I will say, yes, folks, the point of HBR is we will post shows even if the audio is terrible. The idea here is to, if it's audible, it goes on. You did record that with the Zoom H1, did you?
Yeah, and I thought actually that was a lot better than the introduction that I did under Audacity. I noticed that when I edited it. It just seemed my part that I recorded under Audacity was awful rough.
Yeah, in fact, both of them was very, very hard to make out. It's not the worst we've ever had, and the point we will always accept audio so long as it's at least audible. But I did really have to struggle to listen to that one to try and get anything out of it. I had to really do a lot of processing power too, which had me very surprised because the Zoom H2, the quality of the audio is absolutely superb. I don't know what it is about the way you're doing it, 50.
I don't know. I think it may be more of an Audacity problem.
Well, then, can you send me the source files that you have from the Zoom H1? Because I'd really like to get that fixed. If you have better audio than this and your Audacity is ruining it, then we really need to, we might be able to repost that show.
Okay, great. How about the Rackspace interview? Because it was done the same way.
Yeah, if we'll see what the source files are like. If they're as bad, then we know it's the recording. If they're not, then we know something's wrong with the way you're editing them.
Well, what it is when I import the stuff from the H1, it sounds good, but it's way, way, way low compared to what I'm recording locally in Audacity, and I've got my mic gain all the way down pretty much in Audacity. And
yeah, but you can just select
try to it. Amplify.
Yeah, go on.
Well, what I usually do is I amplified it as much as it would allow me to without clipping the original file. And I've got, I say, I did not destroy the original recording. Made it a separate file each time I made a change, then exported it to FLAC. And then when I got imported into the same file as my preamble, I tried to do leveling, and that'll get a little close. The leveling more pulls down my native Audacity recorded stuff than it raises the H1 recorded stuff up. And then really what brings everything to the same level is hitting it with presser.
Yeah, I don't know. Something about your setup might be right. I'd just like to have a look at the files themselves and see if we can do something with the audio. If you have the source files,
thanks.
I can't imagine that they...
Yeah, it's operator error. I don't know enough about what I'm doing with Audacity.
And if... Yeah, I've said it before and I'll say it again. If people have shows, send them to us with the note, please edit this, and we can edit it. We normally don't. I normally don't listen to them except to see if it's audible. And that means, literally, if it's audible, I check the OGG file in three different places to see if it's audible, and then that's it. Because we don't censor here. We don't. If people have comments, we just approve them if they're not spam. If people have shows, we approve them without listening to them. But
and
that said, if there is the opportunity
machine I'm running
to improve...
The machine is not nearly as powerful as the one that I lost a year ago. So that may be... I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not.
Yeah, I'm using a crappy netbook and I've had no problems editing shows with that. So sometimes not doing a lot with them is enough. Okay, moving on to 1824, I'm learning some Python, where John Culp is replacing some of the bash scripts he talked about before for automating stuff with the equivalents using Python. And yeah, I kind of agreed with the... It was a nice solve because he didn't really go into a lot of the nitty-gritty of what he's using, more the type of things that he's using. I was tempted to give it a shot. Everybody seems to be jumping on the Python bandwagon. Just you and me, Dave, here on the Perl.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've also been wondering whether to get more deeply into
Citizen Soul, Dave. Citizen Soul.
I'm abandoning it. Sorry. But there's things like, for example, if you want to parse HTML5, then the Python offerings seem to be better than the Perl ones. I suspect that the movers and shakers have moved away from Perl and have headed off elsewhere to Ruby or to Python, and so there's maybe not the same amount of effort going into those types of modules anymore. So I hope that I'm wrong, that we're not seeing the sort of slow fading of Perl, but there's some areas where it's not as good as it used to be.
Yeah, hopefully it'll come along. The next show was, was there any comments on that episode? I don't think so.
No comments, no.
Not yet, it's fairly early days yet. And LibreOffice template, creating a template for HPR Ahuka, and his slide master, he picked a nice template for this, but we do have the original images, so I can happily make a transparent image for the HPR logo, which... It's one of the items to make all those images and stuff available more prominent on the website that you can get them. So absolutely no reason why the background can't be alpha transparent channel on the background for that. And that, I think, was it for the shows, Dave. Do we have any other comments that were for the earlier episodes?
Yes, we do. We have a comment on... show 1784, which was John Culp's intro to Fugue and the Open Well-Tempered Clavier, from 5150, saying thanks. This comment is belated since I meant to be on the community news for June. John, since you've pulled back the curtain, I will never be able to listen to music in quite the same way again. I think I nearly skipped over this episode and only listened due to politeness. So that's good. That's a good comment. I like that.
It is actually. I don't know what you mean. Sorry, go on.
Then the next one was on 1794, which was another one of John Culp's shows, 12 tone music and my random 12 tone row of the day. Again, 50 commented on Forbidden Planet. Saying this episode reminded me of the theme from every sci-fi film from the 50s, most notably the classic The Forbidden Planet. I hope someone writes a script we can all lend our voices to and you can score. I know what you mean about Forbidden Planet 50, because there's some very, very, very bizarre sounds as they're landing on the planet, I think at the early part of the film, which is pretty amazing. It's state-of-the-art stuff in those days, I think. So, yeah, cool. And go on, son.
The last one was an answer to Kevin's episode on 1800 on YouTube video subscriptions. I asked him for the subscriptions, and they are now all listed there on that episode. So there's nothing stopping me doing my. Doing the show that I promised him.
Yeah, it's a very comprehensive list, that, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Only scanned it. I haven't actually dug into it yet. It's going to take me months to work through that lot, I think.
So shall we go through the mailing list then?
Not a huge lot. Yeah, indeed. So do you want to start, or shall I?
The pictures for which what is the start one?
So the start is Frank Bell asking, are there any specifications of pictures might want to upload when posting a show? So I interpreted him to be asking, what do I do to prepare a picture? And I said, well, here's what I do. And effectively, it was a sort of quick potted version of what I did in that show about image magic.
Yeah, except, and, yeah, no, it was pretty cool, pretty cool. And Kevin replied that he was going to do something on Kira, but it may not happen for a while. Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, that would be good. I would enjoy that.
So the I forwarded on that the FOSDEM episode. FOSDEM is now for the 30th and 31st of January 2016. We could do a table, but we need 8 people. I doubt we're going to get 8 people, so much for that.
Plus, also, the competition is very, very high, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you were there, you would feel guilty of taking the table away from somebody else, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I sent out what was been interpreted as an a cryptic email about the admin email account. And there's an email account, which is admin@hackerpublicradio.org, that goes to me, it goes to Enigma before me and various different people down through the ages. If anybody at any time wants to be part of that mailing list, which tends, or that, I wouldn't say it's a mailing list, it's more a mailing address, it's basically first contact with the hosts and stuff, people asking about, you know, something on the website, or they're looking for stuff. It's nothing ever too hairy or crazy. If you want to do that sort of stuff, then feel absolutely free to do it. You would need to be a, quote, trusted member of the community, meaning we need to know who you are. You've done some shows, that you've been around. That's basically, yeah, anyone who wants to can do that at any time. Have you been getting a lot of spam on that, or do you react to any of the messages? Or
I haven't. I've only had 2 messages that I've noticed so far. My spam filters must be pretty good if there's been any spam of any consequence on it. Just a couple of things so far.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing major. Sometimes it's people confidentially asking stuff that they don't want to go out onto the massive mailing list, or asking how they would approach a particular topic. You know, nothing major. Okay, so if you want to help out with that, or you're just nosy and interested, then yeah, feel free. However, it does come with, you're stepping up to the plate type of thing. So Joshua said that actual feature, forwarding, is being used by spammers for spamming outbound. Which probably explains why Google is considering us to be spam or something. So he's enabled outbound spam filtering, which is a good thing. And then we had you with the community news bulletin. So I think that was pretty much it for the mailing list, pretty much it for the comments.
Yep, quite quiet on the mailing list front this time.
Yeah, it's the middle of middle of summer in the Northern Hemisphere. We also pushed all the code for the HPR website up to the GitLab repo. So there's now a public repo and there's a private repo. The private repo is code waiting to be audited before it can be pushed to the public repo. And the public repo is where everything will be done in the future. So absolutely anybody who wants to be wants to can add their account or OAuth, I think, to the gitlab.anhonesthost.com, who are the providers of our services. And if you go on there, then you can add stuff like to the requested topics page and that sort of thing. If you also get, and if you're involved with PHP at all, can you contact admin@hackerpublicradio.org if you're willing to help out auditing the code that's up there. We would appreciate that. One thing the admin@hackerpublicradio.org gets is the notifications that there's new shows been posted and stuff like that. And basically you keep an eye in the queue and you just do the regular old stuff. And yeah, if I'm not around or Dave isn't around, that you kind of take help out on the back end, so to speak. Let's see, was there anything else that came through that I noticed? Yeah, we also get notifications of postings to Twitter. Oh, there was a suggestion from 5150. 50, are you there still?
Yes, sir.
Do you want to tell us about your suggested topic, please? Or shall I read it out?
Yeah, essentially, I'll try to bring it down to a couple sentences. This is something a few weeks ago we started experimenting with on the Linux Slugcast, is, you know, without a formal Linux server administration background, as a home user, quasi-professional user, I'm not sure exactly what professional level tools that I could employ to secure my home network. I'm thinking of setting up, you know, this basic thing as a pfSense.
He's gone again.
Firewall.
People listening at home won't get the pauses because we've done a truncate silence, but he's can't hear him anymore.
Too many words, Ken?
I'm afraid so, 50. I'm really looking forward to when you get an internet connection.
What I wanted to do is have people comment on who are system admins for website, web servers, for server farms, what free and open tools that they implement to secure their systems that could be implemented on a home network.
How about I read it out here using my internet connection? Question one, beyond the firewall, IDS, ISP, IPS, what do I need? I've started listening to Security Weekly, and they suggested an IDS behind your firewall as your to record what your primary defenses missed. Where and how do I set this up? Beyond the firewall and IDS, what other tools should I be running? Where should they be on my network? And how many physical boxes are we talking about here? Should be low power devices, free as in beer. To that, I will say, I have an episode promised to you, 50, that I will do on the device that I use for this thing. However, right now, the one important thing that you can do to secure your network is read your log files. Suggested topic number two. Now that security is in place, how to read logs, formulate a response to an intrusion. What I've learned from software is that you can't prevent intrusion. It's how to respond to when you are compromised. Again, according to Security Weekly, the security manager's job is to detect intrusions inside 48 hours rather than 48 months. How can you protect your proprietary data and customer database? Question three, what are the answers I need to the questions I don't know enough to ask? Very good. But that's it. I think those are all very, very good topics and definitely need to add it to the list of requested topics. And there was somebody on the Ogcast Planet mailing list looking for that sort of information as well. So if you're out there and this is something you do for a living or have input on, then feel free to record some shows. And also, if you have your own requested topics, either get on the gitlab.anonymoushost.com page and create an account there, or get an account there and edit the pages, or send an email to admin@hackerpublicradio.org and we will add them for you.
And Ken, I think I sent you an email. I did apply for an account on the GitLab and got it, but when I got in, all I could seem to see were bits and pieces of the comments.
Okay, Dave, make it happen.
If you want access to the projects behind, then I can set that up.
Okay, the whole GitLab thing is quite new to us, so bear with us, folks. Bear with us. Okay, was there anything else anyone else had related to HPR?
Nothing here.
Well, then with that, I will say, without further ado, tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of...
Hacker.
Public. Radio.
Radio.
Oh, I am so looking forward to when you get an internet connection, 50. All right, good night, folks. Tune in tomorrow.
We're not going to sing?
Join us now and share the
software. You'll be free, hackers. You'll be free.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.